What does Hannah Arendt have to say about diabetes medication? How can breaking your foot make you think more deeply about the guiding principles of the economy? Are we bound as a globe to get more and more chronically ill, or is there a way to turn this around? Have the major crises of health in the 21st century, from opioid addiction to the pandemic, got precursors in history? And how did we deal with them last time? How do we bring well-being back on to center stage? It starts with care.
Successive governments have tried and failed to solve this, and yet here we are. Tonight, we can reveal the true scale of the care home funding crisis.
We're talking about the fundamentals of everyday living, being able to get out of bed, get yourself dressed in the morning and eat and use the toilet.
Around a fifth of these rooms are occupied by people who don't need to be here, housed in a care home, because like thousands of others, they can't get care in their own home.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Zoe Williams, and my co-host, Seema Saeeda. Our guest today on today's show is Tim Jackson, ecological economist, author of Prosperity Without Growth, longtime friend of this podcast, back with a new book, The Care Economy.
Hi, this is Seema. I joined Another Europe Is Possible in 2018. For me, the most important thing about this space is building a transnational movement for a more democratic economy, anti-racist politics, and global solidarity beyond nationalism. So that's why I hope you join the Another Europe Is Possible family too. Go to anotheureup.org/join and sign up to get access to an extended version of this podcast.
Hi Tim, welcome to the podcast.
Hello Zoe, it's lovely to be here again.
So Tim, you've described in the book that one of the problems properly valuing care is that it is conceived as women's work, mainly done by women, and is thought to embody feminine values. What would those values be? How do they differ from the masculine? Are we talking about a failure of self-assertion by women, or are we talking about something deeper?
I would say, first of all, I suppose that it being cast as women's work is in part a social phenomenon, and it's something that has sort of deepened through the 20th century and retained its power in the 21st century. And the reality of it is still quite striking that in spite of four waves of feminism, care, broadly speaking, is seen as women's work. 90% of nurses are still women, for example. And by contrast, 90% of military personnel are men. So there's a kind of social division between looking after things and breaking them apart so that they need mending, if you like, in some funny kind of way. And the question of why that's happened has so many answers. It's a fascinating question. Is it just as the first and second wave feminists would like to think? Is it just a kind of social conditioning? Is it just something that society has done to women and something that it's also simultaneously, as it turns out, done to men? That was really one of the first sort of positions on this. And it was articulated very, very clearly by a woman called Carol Gilligan, who was writing in the 1970s, 1980s, in the second wave of feminism, really. And it was an argument that, broadly speaking, most of our understanding of how humans developed neglected what was happening to women. Most of it paid a lot of attention to men. And so it developed an understanding of our moral universe that is very much about how boys grow up in society. And how boys grow up in society, it turns out, surprise, surprise, is very, very different from how women grow up in society. But nonetheless, our developmental studies were listening basically only to young boys and teenagers, and they weren't listening to young girls and teenage girls. And so what they found was that the moral universe, according to men, according to boys, according to the development of boys, was a very, very different place from the development as according to girls. And what was happening to young men was that essentially they were being kind of conditioned out of care and towards a sort of ethic of justice. And Carol Gilligan looked at this and sort of said, well, look, you know, all these studies, you've not been listening to girls. You're not listening to women here. What would happen if you did? And she was actually carrying out a study with young girls, adolescents at that point in time, around a couple of moral issues. And what she discovered was very specifically that this ethic that belonged more to women than to men was conceived of in terms of care, in terms of relationship, in terms of looking after the other. And she wrote a book called In a Different Voice, which captured this idea brilliantly, that actually, you know, what was happening was that women, girls, young women and teenagers in particular were speaking with a very different voice from the one that most of developmental psychology had listened to. And this different voice was telling us something different about the moral universe, that women see their relationship to the moral universe in a completely different way. Now, I mentioned that's kind of long and deep in its origins, and it goes, you know, various ways of casting this apparent difference, this gender difference, if you like, go back and back into evolutionary psychology, which is something perhaps we can talk about, how we adapted as species, what we adapted out of, what our gender roles were in the ancestral environment, all that kind of stuff. But interestingly, Carol Gilligan also took it forwards into today. And a couple of years ago, she wrote a book called In a Human Voice. And what In a Human Voice says is that she had kind of missed something when she identified this gender division, that it wasn't a hard and fast gender division that was programmed into the difference between men and women at all. It was actually that we as human beings have both these kinds of characteristics in us. And that it's to some extent a function of society that we've split that along gender lines. But the care as a phenomenon in particular is fundamentally human. It's something that belongs to all of us rather than just to one gender or another.
If I can just pick up on something before we move off that, it struck me in your book that you mention almost as if it's something we all know, that the opposite of care is violence, and there is a kind of equally violent strain in our conception of ourselves as humans. Whereas in Gilligan's work, she's kind of situating the masculine perspective as justice and rule-based and the feminine perspective as care and relational. Do you think that, you know, that notion of building just systems contains within it the willingness to do violence?
I think it contains the ability to neglect the fact that you're doing violence, particularly when it's unbalanced by care. I think in a sense, you're right. I pitch that idea of violence as care's nemesis. And it isn't quite a kind of founding construct, I think, in the sense that Gilligan sees justice and rule-based ethics as a founding construct, whether that's of men or of a part of humanity that lives within all of us. It is, I think, what goes wrong when care gets left out of that rule-based environment, when it becomes expunged from society and from social relationships because we've paid so little attention to it. And so in the sense that that masculine, as Gilligan conceived it, that masculine rule-based, justice-based ethic has predominated in society, it's been a place that's allowed us as a society to overlook those places where violence enters our lexicon without us even really registering its impact on the other. So whereas care has its foundational outlook on the other and on the question of relationship, justice and rules are the things that can protect us from having to make moral decisions in the sense of their impact on others, because we're simply following the rules. And actually, that is to some extent where Hannah Arendt came in, sort of identifying actually that this very rule-based culture is a place where violence can proliferate and where ethically and morally things can go badly wrong.
That's so interesting. And for me, something I've been thinking about a lot recently, actually, is the way feminism, as I came to know it and growing up, was always about giving women the right to do the things that men do. So the right to have equal pay, or the right to work, or the right to run society in the same way that men do. But there was never this emphasis on valuing the work that is traditionally held by women, care work, and getting men to actually take those roles on more. So it was always positioning, you know, masculine energy and masculine styles of being as the pinnacle, and denigrating traditional women's work.
I guess, Seema, coming back to that aspect of feminism, which is talking about women doing everything that men can do, and just as well, thank you very much, and please give us this power in society to do that. That is definitely one part of feminism. But there is, as Mary Harrington has pointed out, there's a sort of a second strand which has been there from quite a long time ago. The idea that actually there are parts of what it means to be in the world, and this is also Carol Gilligan's point, which are neglected in that highly competitive, we can do better than you, women can do everything that men can do. And that neglect is precisely of care itself and the valuing of care as a part of what it means to be human, a part that has traditionally been carried by women and been classified as women's work, but actually is critically important to the survival of the human species, to our quality of life. Mary Harrington describes a kind of schism within feminism between what she calls team freedom, which is that perspective which says women can do anything that men can do, please just give us the freedom to do it, and team care. And that team care part of it is a valuation of something that was traditionally held very much as a part of what women are and do in society, but actually is critically important to the whole of society. And feminism itself has sort of been torn between saying, are we protecting this thing that has been called women's work, but is critical to society? Or are we just trying to go where men can go and have that sense of freedom and exploration of the world and get to the highest positions in all the companies and have political power and so on and so forth? And that is a place, I think, where feminism has kind of not quite come to a final resolution, if there is such a thing, of that sort of division. And it partly hasn't been able to do that because of the fate of care itself in society.
Brilliant. Yeah, this is a really interesting discussion. And I think it's so important that we can try and envision how our society does move towards a model that really centres care. And one of the key infrastructures that we have here in the UK, obviously around care and health, is the NHS. And do you think the fact that health and care, which have diverged so early within the NHS system and so systematically, when we build universal medical treatment, will we set up care to be the poor relation? And is there any way to redress this?
Well, I think there's definitely ways to redress it. And I would say that that positioning of care as a poor relation happened quite a long time ago. So it happened before the NHS was created to some extent, and it continued through the NHS. And that division followed a sort of gender basis. So the professionalization of medicine in the early 20th century, for example, was very much about protecting the territory of men as the curers, those who administered health to other people and were, in some sense, held a kind of social power in society from doing that. And the carers, which was broadly held by the profession of nursing. And that happened systematically back in the early part of the 20th century. There was a report written for the Carnegie Foundation in the US by a guy called Abraham Flexner. And Flexner basically was given the remit to sort of professionalize medicine, to cut out all the naturopathy and the homeopathy and all these things that were associated with a sense of lay healing in this in society at the time, and to make it scientific, to make it modern, scientific, and professionalized. And whether by default or by design, the process of doing that managed to expunge much of what was really in the domain of care and much of what was in the domain of women's role in society as lay healers, and to put in its place this kind of very hierarchical system of professional medical people who relied on science and on biochemistry and what happened in the lab to decide how we address the health of the population. And so by the time we get to the NHS, we have a kind of rag bag of professionalized but privatized health systems around the country, which is poorly serving the poorest in society, and which has also introduced a kind of a quackery, the selling of cures for all kinds of things without any kind of scientific basis for them. And although that was part of what Flexner was trying to get rid of, in a sense, it didn't work in the context of health and care in the way that it was working in British society at that time, and in many other places, it has to be said. And that was very, very well recognized before the Second World War in particular, where the health of the poorest was suffering, declining quite rapidly, where the access to health was not assured unless you could pay for it, and where when you could pay for it, quite often you were buying sort of vanity cures. It was satirized in a novel called The Citadel by A.J. Cronin back in the 1930s. And the novel became very foundational, actually, in building the concept of the NHS. And that was the point at which Bevan arrived at the scene, Nye Bevan, out of a Welsh valley where a different model of healthcare had been built into that small town over several decades. And he could see, in fact, that actually, if you could provide a healthcare, universal healthcare, free at the point of need, you could get to a system that would allow care and cure to be integrated in a way that was available to everyone. So that was really the foundation of the NHS. It's a fascinating story when you look into the detail. And when you go to the birthplace, as I did during the writing of the book, a place called Tredegar in Wales, which is now one of those post-industrial towns that was once a thriving mining town, coal mining and iron and steel works, and is now very much in a kind of post-industrial slough. But out of this fantastic kind of history of being once a very important industrial town and then becoming seeing in decline, you can sort of see this emergence of a vision for what it means to have a healthy society, what it means to take health seriously, what it means to integrate care into that system, and what it means to put, for the first time really in our country, that concept of universal access to healthcare at the point of need at the center of how you organize the welfare society. The NHS is the crowning jewel, was the crowning jewel of the welfare society, the welfare state. And so that's, you know, that sort of fascinating kind of example shows you both the precursor to the NHS, which was an absolute mess and which had been ripped apart along gender lines in ways which created a schism within healthcare itself, towards a vision of something that could do better. And it's also one of the reasons, I think, why we in the UK love the NHS so much. It's always been a kind of crown jewel in the welfare state. It's always been something that people will protect, even as it's gone wrong. And the situation we find ourselves now in then is even more, you know, fascinating for that very reason. How has it gone so wrong? Why has it gone so wrong? Was it the schism that already existed before it was formed? To some extent, the answer is yes. But are there other factors involved? And what are those other factors? One of them, as I come to in the book, is massive change in the burden of disease, which when the NHS was formed was mainly about curing infectious disease and righting injuries and wrongs and things that could be cured with operations. So between sort of the rise of antibiotics to treat infectious disease and the improvements in treating injuries at work, in the workplace, at home, and improvements in surgery, those two things were doing a pretty good job getting a hold on the global burden of disease. But since the NHS was formed, in fact, that burden of disease has shifted massively, partly as a result of the success of treating infectious diseases and being better at surgery, but also because of things that have happened in society. We have seen the massive rise in what's called chronic disease, non-communicable diseases, so diabetes, heart disease, cancer, musculoskeletal diseases, things which are not transferred by infection, things which you can't necessarily fix just by mending a broken bone, things which are intimately related to the way that we lead and live our lives.
I mean, that does bring us back to, there is a flip side to that patriarchal, sorry to be giving men such a kicking, but you know what I mean, that patriarchal model which gave rise to the medical idea of national well-being was also mirrored in public health initiatives, right back to the Victorian times, where if you saw a public health crisis looming as a result of collective behaviours, people stepped in and knew how to stop it, right? They knew how to block the water supply and build sewage systems and prevent cholera. And when we talk now about the global burden of chronic disease and all the things that feed into it, not least the food industry, what is it that's made us lose our confidence about dealing with those publicly, kind of anthropogenically created crises? And how could a narrative of care make us rediscover that confidence?
Well, that's exactly what my journey through the book was. And let me say that right to start, you know, absolutely no need to apologize about slapping the patriarchy in the face. And no need to apologize, really, to me at least, for what seems to be a kind of attack on men. I mean, it was one of the difficult things when I was writing the book, when I sat down initially to write it. And I had the kind of founding ideas very, very early on, from work that goes right back to prosperity without growth, the idea that prosperity is better conceived as health than as wealth, and the idea that therefore if health is your aim, then you need care in order to achieve it rather than growth at all costs. Kind of that's where I came at it from. And as soon as I stepped into the arena of articulating it for the book, the first thing that came back and slapped in my face at that point was the fact that I'm a man and this is women's territory. And it's been talked about very, very successfully and very articulately by women over quite a long period of time. So that sense, in fact, that gender was a part of the conversation, it was part of the journey, was a quite an uncomfortable one for me, I have to say, in the early stages of it. And it is something which has remained uncomfortable through the writing of the book, because it does seem to me that a part of what's happened is related to gender, and it is related to what you could call a kind of institutional patriarchy. It's a sense in which it's not just about the views and values that we profess to hold and that men can, you know, now change their ideas about or not, but that actually those values are written down and coded into the institutions that structure the way that we organize society. And it's that sense of institutional lock-in, if you like, that I think is really the answer to your question there. How did it come to be? How did this position come to be where what was due to men was really the way that we organized all of the health service, the way that we organized our responses to chronic disease? And it's not quite as simple as saying that it's just men who have done that. What's more true is to say that patriarchal institutions have created a structure, and that structure still lives even inside the NHS in ways which prevent us seeing what is now becoming blindingly obvious, that we've neglected the care of our lives, the care of our lifestyles, the care of our food system, the care of our health, and believed that we could fix any of the problems coming as a result of that neglect through the relatively masculine, I would say, structures of cure, which are perpetuated themselves by technology. And those technologies are in part the technologies which allow us to operate very well. And you have to say that that is one of the aspects of the healthcare system, which is fantastic, our ability to do that better than we could before. But in large part also through pharmaceutical drugs. So that when we look at disease, we see the solution as pharmaceutical drugs. And there's another part of the argument from what happened back in the early 20th century of why that has happened. Why is it that our medicine has been basically shifted towards a place where we cut things and mend things on the one hand, or find a drug to fix it on the other hand? And that is partly, at least there is a very strong and I think quite persuasive argument to suggest that that is partly the case, because when that shift in medicine was happening, it was a direct conflict between two different ways of thinking about care and about health. And the one that won out was the one where it was possible to see profit. This was the rise of a kind of industrial capitalism. It was the height of what were called the robber barons. And the robber barons, amongst those robber barons, was Carnegie himself, who looked at health and actually saw dollar signs. He looked at health and he saw a place where if you could cast it in this way, then there would be money to be made out of a pharmaceutical industry. And the relationship between the pharmaceutical industry and the oil industry and the chemicals industry was already quite well established at that point. You could begin to see a place where you could grow the economy through profit. And that's, I think, the most fundamental conflict in the book, in a sense, is this conflict, this tension between thinking of something through the lens of whether you can grow the economy and make profit out of it versus thinking about something in the context of how you can promote its health. That same contrast, which I'd started with, that same conflict, if you like, prosperity as health or prosperity as wealth, the choice was made back in the early 20th century to pursue prosperity as wealth and to look at things like health through a wealth-based lens. And so the solutions that we've put in place have been dominated by very, very powerful vested interests in what care and cure should mean within our health system.
Talking about this profit motive, traditional neoliberal economics purported this idea that through economies of scale, eventually all goods will become cheaper and this will create a much better life for everyone. And as you mentioned, technology is the answer to health problems. But this hasn't actually happened. And this is something that your book interrogates. There's this key question. Why, for instance, are computers getting cheaper while medicine gets more expensive? And what are the underlying market factors that are causing this? And can the market actually ever understand care as you've described it?
Yeah, the market has to be, I think, the servant rather than the master when it comes to care. You know, that's very clear when you begin to talk about something like social care, where, you know, social care is a responsibility of government to look after people, particularly when they're ill or whether they're old or whether they're very, very young. That responsibility rests with governments to ensure the welfare of the population. But when you hand those tasks into the market and allow them to become fodder for the profit motive, that's the point in which you generate huge moral hazard. And that moral hazard, I think, is why the social care system in particular is in such a devastating place in this country, because the equity ownership of social care, for example, often has offshore accounts where the profits flow, shareholders who benefit. But the casualties of that system in delivering social care have been that the government has to keep underwriting that, has to keep putting the money in the system. And the more money it puts in the system, the less it solves the problem, because the profit motive really is trying to squeeze ever greater profits out of that system. And it must therefore almost necessarily squeeze the wages of the people that are providing the care and reduce the quality of the care itself. And all of those things have happened. You know, the evidence on that is now really, really clear, that that kind of marketization of social care has been devastating for the provision of social care. But you were asking, Seema, about the, you know, what's the fundamental point there? And I think the fundamental point there is that care is something that demands time and attention. Time is something that the market tries to squeeze out of the working relationship. It continually has its eyes on productivity, because productivity means less time spent by workers, less wages spent on workers, and therefore greater profits for shareholders. And that idea of productivity is so central within capitalism. It's so key to how capitalism is structured and how the market works, that it is very, very difficult to see how it can ever fully accommodate care within its own existing market ethos. And that's my point, I suppose, to come back to it, is that that's why I think we have to see the market not as the master of how we organize things, but as the servant of how we organize things, particularly when it comes to public health. And we haven't done that.
And on that kind of capitalism as a structural force ranged implacably against the well-being of nations, what does Hannah Arendt have to say on this? Because I know that it's not a straight feminist perspective.
Yeah, it's not a feminist perspective. I mean, mainly the thing that fascinates me with Arendt, and it's something that she puts forward in The Human Condition, is a kind of distinction in two different ways of interacting in the world, one which she calls labor and one which she calls work. And quite often we put those two things together and we don't see a difference between them. But she teases them apart in a really interesting way. She talks about labor as those kind of visceral tasks of keeping ourselves well, of looking after our nutrition, of looking after people when they're ill, when they're small, when they're elderly, of doing all that it takes to survive as a human being and to help others survive. And broadly speaking, of course, that captures a lot of the work that we would call care in society. And then she says something really fascinating, or to me it's very fascinating, which is that this was always, throughout history, this was a time-absorbing task, this task of labor, the labor of survival. But she says, when you look up from that task, when you have enough time to step away from the sort of visceral messiness of, you know, changing nappies and dressing wounds and digging vegetables and preparing meals, when you step away from that, you have time to look at something else. And what you look at when that time is absolutely terrifying. It's the prospect of our own mortality. While you're engaged in that visceral act of survival, you don't have much time to contemplate that. But as soon as you stop it, you look up and you begin to see, actually, oh, okay, I'm a finite human being living in a fragile planet, in circumstances which are deeply insecure. And ultimately, what's going to happen is I'm going to die. And not worse than that, the people I love are going to die, and I'm going to have to sit around and watch it. And that according to Arend and many other psychologists, actually, becomes a kind of motivation, that mortality, the existence and the awareness of our own mortality becomes a kind of motivation to build something more durable, to create a durable world, to create something that will last even if we don't. And that's what she talks about in terms of the word work. And work is this process of constructing a durable world, of escaping in some minimal sense from our own mortality and creating something that lasts. And that, to some extent, explains that sort of division. As we got more technologically competent, we gave ourselves more time, and that time, upon a rather insecure reflection on our own mortality, became a process of building empire, of creating power, of creating durable monuments to ourselves into the future, of striving for success, of striving for status. So all of that is driven, in a sense, by a kind of fear of our mortality. But here's the most interesting thing about that division, it seems to me, is that both of those things are ill-served within capitalism for two completely different reasons. The reason that labor is ill-served within capitalism is something we've already seen, that it takes time, and capitalism doesn't like to take time. It likes to push time out of the equation. The reason that work is ill-served, although we see plenty of it, we see plenty of busyness, we see empire building till the world is being destroyed around our ears by the process of empire building. What it does is, inside capitalism, is not to satisfy the underlying need. In other words, what capitalism needs is us for continue to be having to continue to build. It can't allow us ever to reach a state of durability, this state that Arendt says is what we're trying to achieve through work, because durability is an anathema to capitalism. If things don't fall apart, if they don't collapse, there's no incentive to build anew, to have new things, to create new structures. There's no activity for the economy to grasp itself on in creating bigger and bigger structures. And that's what capitalism is obsessed with. So capitalism comes in, it looks at this schism between labor and work, between the work of care and the sense of our coping in some way with our mortality, coming to terms with our mortality. And it's basically manages to destroy both of them for reasons which are built into the structure of capitalism, and in particular its core values and the way that those values are articulated in the market.
Thanks so much, Tim. And I think this note about the structure of capitalism as a cause of the crisis of care is a really key note to end on. And I do see these structural critiques returning into the language of feminism, and perhaps the next wave of feminism, I think, maybe led by figures like Françoise Vergès in France, who in 2019, she published A Decolonial Feminism. And that really brings back these structural critiques about care.
So, Tim, it's a confusing picture in America, with Kennedy Jr. as a rabid anti-vaxxer, but also very anti-big food and big pharma. Oh, is there anything for a kind of left-wing rebuttal to do with this anti-corporatism to kind of bring it back into a natural left-wing discourse and not let them run away with it?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think one of the things we have to do and be very careful about is to look at how we're presented with some of what's coming out of the alt-right. And it's been understandable, entirely understandable, but also politically not massively successful from the progressive left, that they, instead of listening to some of the core underlying messages, they've attended to attack the messengers, to shoot the messenger. And I think to some extent, this has happened in the debate around Make America Healthy Again, and in some of what RFK Jr. is trying to do. And I'm not defending his views on vaccination, which I think have been misrepresented in the press. I'm not defending his switch of allegiance out of the Democrats and into a kind of form of republicanism that makes very little sense even to Republicans. I don't want to be an apologist for RFK in that way, but I do think that the way in which that argument has been treated by the progressive left has not acknowledged some of the fundamental things that are going on. So we talked in the main part of the podcast about chronic disease. Chronic disease is to a large extent a disease of the metabolism. The metabolism is intimately linked to our lifestyles, to what's going on. It's linked to what we eat. It's linked to the medicines we take. It's linked to the pollutants in the atmosphere. These are all things that RFK Jr. has been very forthright about, not always in entirely clear ways, not always in ways which are entirely defensible, sometimes in ways which are provocative. But actually behind those provocations lies an emerging science which has quite a lot of authority. And in particular, the authority about the relationship between food and health. If we eat in ways which consistently underline our metabolism, as we do in modern society, that breakdown of the metabolism, something that's called metabolic syndrome, sometimes called metabolically dysfunctional, metabolic dysfunction, that is the precursor to almost every chronic disease that we know. And the science on that is very, very strong, and it has not been sufficiently adopted by the progressive left. And it's partly not been adopted by the progressive left, I think, because its implications are so profound. They are that you have to profoundly think that relationship between food and health. You have to rethink your food industry. You have to rethink what the pharmaceutical industry has been doing. One of the kind of curses that the progressive left has to bear, and you can see it in this country in the two big shifts towards the left. In 1997, when Tony Blair came into power, in 2024, last year, when Keir Starmer came into power, they had to prove their credentials to essentially to the city, to the finance sector and to the industries that supported the finance sector. They had to prove that they were not anti-business. And that desire to prove that you're not anti-business can actually be a real burden when it comes to understanding what needs to be done to shift chronic disease. Because to shift chronic disease, you have to move away from a food system based on processed calories, engineered calories, and force-fed to people through cheap junk foods that undermine their health. And you have to think about how you can support a food sector which gives you back health, make the UK healthy again. And that's the sense in which what RFK and Make America Healthy Again is at least setting out to do. They've given themselves 100 days, which seems like an extraordinarily short time to begin to understand what that relationship is between what the causal mechanisms of chronic health are. And they are very, very complex. But that profound link between food and health means that you do have to rethink the way that we think about and talk about progressive disease. And rather than simply shooting the messenger, look at the underlying structural problem, which is that we've created a food system, partly for good reasons, because we want to produce as many calories as cheaply as possible for people who can't afford to eat. But actually, it's been devastating exactly for those poor people who bear the brunt of the disease caused by a food system that's making them unhealthy. And then avoid doing what actually Starmer did do very early on, which was to kind of get in bed with a big pharmaceutical company, Eli Lilly, and say, don't worry, we've got the solution to this. It exists in another drug that we can give you to fix the problem that food has created. And guess what? It's another multi-billion dollar industry, which is going to contribute to growth in society. So when Starmer stood up and talked about the intervention in Manchester to try out anti-obesity drugs in Manchester for a short period through this collaboration with Eli Lilly, it came on a day, not when he was talking about the NHS and health, but on a day when he was trying to prove that the UK was open to business, that we were open to investment. And this investment was critical because it was going to address this problem for us. And it was, again, a sort of handing over of the problem to the domination of the market in ways which are profoundly dysfunctional without addressing what's going on underneath, without addressing that underlying relationship. To me, it's paradoxical that the critique of the underlying business model that has driven a crisis in chronic health is coming not from the progressive left, where I have been working for decades and would have expected it to come from, but actually from an alt-right that in much of what else is doing scares the shit out of me.
You talk in your book about care for the planet being part of the picture of care for each other. Do you think environmentalists need to get less misanthropic and marry the care agendas better in their campaigning?
Yes, I do. Yeah. You know, I think that care in a sense becomes a kind of, and partly because of that, you know, political paradox that we were just talking about, it becomes something that can be can appeal on and should appeal on all sides of the spectrum. I think that's my positioning of care as a fundamentally human aspect of survival, of our sense of ourself, of our identity, of our society. Positioning it in that way brings it out of party politics and places it within the domain of interest of ordinary people, of those on the left and those on the right, of those who think about care of the planet and those who don't think about care of the planet. It has a kind of convening power as an argument, as does our health, as does our right to decent, wholesome, real food. All of those things, I think, have a kind of power, at least that's my hope, is they have a kind of convening power in a debate that has, to some extent, been weaponized by political interests in order to undermine the green agenda. And that's something which I, as a long-time environmentalist, I look on with absolute horror, the kind of weaponization of that debate. But just as there is, to some extent, a culpability amongst progressive left for overlooking the relationships which now the alt-right is beginning to expose, there's perhaps a culpability in that progressive environmental left in overlooking some of the more fundamental things that are going on. For example, you know, we still have a tendency, even within the environmental dialogue around climate change, to point to and to want to promote technological solutions, because technological solutions live within the logic of the market. There's going to be profits made for someone in curing all these problems that growth and capitalism have themselves solved. So we don't have to think too much about the system. We just have to move on to the technologies. Whereas actually, you know, what's interesting, if you think about the transition to a net zero society, for example, yes, you can put renewables in place. And yes, that's a very good idea. Yes, you can improve the efficiency of people's homes. And yes, that is a very good idea, too. But you also have to look at what we're doing in society, what we're spending our time on, what our work is involved in, what our labor is involved in. And when you look at it from that perspective, you find something really interesting, which is that the care sector, those activities which are more reliant on people's time, are less material and carbon intensive than those activities which you can easily mechanize, which produce stuff very quickly, and which absorb enormous amounts of materials and increasing amounts of energy. So you have a kind of split within the economy that actually tells you that you can't fix the problem just by chasing ever cleverer technologies and hoping they're going to solve it all for you. Because at the same time, you're creating orphans, you're creating second-class citizens, you're creating a care economy which is denigrated and abused and underpaid. And actually, this sector of the economy, this sector that's vital for our health, which demands the time and attention of people to each other, this sector of the economy is also profoundly a green economy. It is light in materials relative to the other part of the economy. It's light in energy. It absorbs labor. There's an infinite capacity for labor in that part of the economy. When you look at that situation around what's happened in the green debate through the lens of thinking about care, you kind of end up in a different place. You end up thinking that actually, in constantly harping on about technological solutions to climate change, to biodiversity, you have misread the fundamental nature of the problem, which is that we are underprivileging a central part of our economy, which has nothing to do with materials and energy in the intensity that it has in the technological part of the economy, and has everything to do with our quality of life, our health, how we organize ourselves, how we relate to each other, how we care.
I mean, it's so satisfying how well this care work marries to the prosperity without growth work. I mean, obviously you thought that through, but it's, as a reader, it's just so wonderful to watch it evolve.
Yeah, it sort of flow from it. I mean, I think it flowed from two things, this book, really. One was that very simple early message that, you know, 15 years or so ago I was doing when we were thinking about prosperity differently, when I was an economics commissioner on the UK Sustainable Commission, and realizing that actually what matters to most people first and foremost is health. And then the obvious kind of corollary that if you want health, then you have to think about care, and you have to think about what happens to care in the economy, which is, you know, that stuff actually was all in Prosperity Without Growth quite early on. And I felt when I sat down to write the book, I thought it was going to be easy to write because I knew what the answers were. I kind of knew where I was coming from. I knew what those two simple propositions were, and they were both pretty simple. So I almost, you could explain it in a page. Prosperity is health, economy is care. That's basically it. And then the other thing, you know, the other thing that happened when I sat down and write it was actually, this is so blindingly obvious. Why doesn't it happen? You know, why are we in such a mess in relation to something so fundamentally human? And then the other thing that slightly complicated it for me to go back to the beginning of our conversation in the main bit of the podcast was that I'm a man and most of this has been talked about by women. So as soon as you kind of, I began to be drawn into this mess of why doesn't it happen and what can I possibly say about it in being a man talking about this in this domain, that became for me the process of writing the book. And it drastically changed actually how the book turned out from the way I thought I would set about writing it, and certainly made the process a lot longer, more complicated, but also absolutely fascinating.